Good morning. Very vigorous singing, we've noticed. Pleasure to see you all here, particularly the young people scattered throughout the room, seated with their families. Very glad to see you. This morning, the advertised topic is the strengths and weaknesses of Darwinism. What strengths? Don't know why I agreed to that title. There it is. As of last night, I'll begin by speaking for 45 minutes, set up the question period when you can all get in with whatever you want to ask about. You might be thinking about that while I'm trying to give you something to ask questions about. I would say that the most important strength of Darwinism is that it fits in with and embodies a certain way of thinking about the world which is dominant in our times. It's a certain way of thinking. In chapter 3 of my most recent book, The Right Questions, I tell of the summer of 2001 when I was engaged for a few days in an email exchange with Richard Dawkins. Dawkins is the professor at Oxford University, who is the world's foremost Darwinist these days, and also the world's foremost propagandist for atheism. Dawkins writes about biology, but his interest is not really in biology, it's atheism. Biology is important to him insofar as it provides a justification for atheism, which is his true interest. So that he was just an ordinary teacher at Oxford when one of his admirers is Charles Simonyi, who is among Bill Gates' partners as the founders of Microsoft, and so, of course, he has a lot of money. And Simonyi chose to lavish this wealth, something like $28 million of it, on Oxford University to endow a chair for Richard Dawkins. That means a special professorship, where he didn't have any teaching duties, so he could devote himself full-time to the public understanding of science. He's professor of the public understanding of science, and that means to Dawkins the public appreciation of atheism. He is just constantly bombarding the newspapers with op-ed columns and letters about how what an evil thing Christianity or any other religion is, and how it must be stamped out. And that's the job of the scientist, in his view. So Dawkins wanted to entrap me in a line of questions that would get me into trouble. Essentially, he wanted to see if I was a relatively rational opponent of Darwinism, if there can be such a thing, or one of the crazies. So he said, in order to tell this, he would ask me this question: did I concede that the lobster and the human being share a common ancestor? See, the idea is here that if I accept common ancestry and yet just challenge the details of the Darwinian mechanism, then I'm relatively rational. And so that's the answer I'm supposed to give, is yes, I accept the common ancestry principle. So I'm not one of those religious right-wing creationists. I knew where that was going. So I said, no, I do not accept that common ancestry principle, because in the first place, this alleged common ancestor of lobsters and humans has not been found, identified. It exists only in your imagination, Richard. And more scientifically, there is no mechanism which can transform some hypothetical being on one line of biological descent into a lobster, and on another line of biological descent into a human being. Such transformations like that never occur. They aren't recorded in the fossil record, nor can they be demonstrated in the laboratory. So there's nothing scientific about this. So Dawkins said, well, then I know what you are. You're one of those creationists and totally irrational. Probably a Bible believer. I want nothing to do with you. I said, very well, Richard. Now, I have a question for you. First, let me explain a little bit further what Dawkins was getting at. You see, if once I said, yes, I do believe in the common ancestry principle, but I just challenged the creative power of natural selection, he would have me in a trap. See, because common ancestry itself is a mechanism. You see, we know what ancestors are. They're like our grandparents. You see, we have great-grandparents who give birth to their descendants' grandparents. And the grandparents' descendants are parents, and then the parents' descendants are, at the end of the line, the children. You see. And all of this happens. We're all slightly different from our great-grandparents, but any changes have come about simply as a result of the mixing of genes and various environmental things that have happened during the course of the development of the embryos or whatever. There's no need for creative acts of God or anyone else, any special creative activity. It's just the variation in the gene pool that brings about these slight differences that make us slightly different from our great-grandparents. So once I accept the common ancestry principle, I'm essentially saying that the same thing is true in terms of that common ancestor of lobsters and humans. So purely natural, step-by-step process of random genetic changes brought this about, along with the crafting power of natural selection. And if I balk at that, I say, well, I don't know that natural selection has such a power to craft these differences. Well, what else was involved? You've already conceded the common ancestry principle. You didn't need a miracle to bring about your existence from your grandparents. This is just a purely natural process. So that was where Dawkins had hoped to trap me. And he said, well, now I've got you in the other fork of the trap, which is that you're a creationist and you don't concede the common ancestry principle. So either way, you lose. And I said, oh, very well, Richard. Now I want to ask you a question. Why do you believe in the existence of this hypothetical common ancestor of lobsters and humans? What makes its existence plausible to you? Tell me, is it something that you know as a biologist that I do not know? Is it something you've seen in your microscope? Some scientific discovery that you've made? What gives you this confidence? Or is it just a philosophical position you hold, that there must be such a common ancestor, whether it can ever be discovered or not? It's just philosophy. And Dawkins gave me a pretty straightforward answer. He said, well, philosophy is involved. He said, it's what I mean by an explanation. Right? To explain the derivation of humans from some animal form by a natural process of mutation and selection is a scientific explanation, which is the only kind of explanation there is. Now, if you are going to explain the existence of human beings on the basis of a miraculous act of creation, that is not an explanation at all. It's not so much that it's a false explanation, it's that it doesn't qualify as an explanation in the first place. Because it leaves the creator unexplained. That doesn't work. So this is the very notion of what constitutes an explanation in a culture in which scientific thinking is dominant in intellectually. It's the only game in town. The famous crooked crap game. It's, why are you gambling? Can anyone to gamble? It's the only game in town. The thought of not gambling is inconceivable to the poor man. Well, what it's like. It's the only explanation. And then the attraction of this philosophical way of thinking is that thinking in this way, the technical term for this way of thinking, of defining what an explanation is reductionism. Reductionism means explaining anything in terms of the fundamental material causes which cause it to exist. You reduce it to material causes, so that's the reductionism. And Dawkins would say, to justify this way of thinking, well, this way of thinking, reductionist explanations, has given us unprecedented power over nature and has liberated us from the dark forces of superstition and control by priests. So we have a physical control of nature and freedom from a control by the priests. Of course, Dawkins himself is one of the leading priests of the materialist religion. So we aren't going to be free from domination by his kind of priesthood. But he thinks we should regard that, to change of masters, as liberating. So that is the greatest strength of the Darwinist theory, is that it is seen as the greatest triumph of this scientific reductionist thinking. And the ultimate justification for the reductionist thinking as well. Dawkins wrote in one of his books that if an explorer from a group of explorers from another star system discovers the Earth and sees that there are intelligent beings on it, the first question they will ask about us is, have they found out about evolution yet? So that will determine whether we're fit to join the galactic civilization or not. So whether we know the truth about our creation and have put away the myths. So acceptance of this way of thinking and the theory of evolution that's an essential part of it is an essential part of what it means to be rational in the a dominant a view in intellectual circles in the post-Darwinian times, in the century and a half of since the Darwin's theory, it's become that a dominant. Now, so this way of thinking has given us mastery over nature so that we can fly through the air and so on. It promises to give us a freedom from disease. Dawkins would think, and hence allow us to do all sorts of things that we couldn't do in the past because of fear of consequences that we couldn't control. Now, we see this working out in, for example, the great process, one might say the great orgy of sexual liberation that followed the Darwinian triumphal year, the centennial year that I talked about last night in 1959, the great sexual liberation of the 1960s. And so one of the freedoms that we have is science has provided the ability to do a thing, to do things and get away with them that we couldn't before. I mentioned that in the time of Epicurus, the ancient Greek philosopher who started this whole line of thinking, that we must be free of the gods in order to be truly free, Epicurus said we have to live very modest lives, you know, because if you're sexually unrestrained, you'll get disease. And if you don't watch your diet very carefully, if you I doubt you'll get a disease. But in his book on moral Darwinism, Professor Benjamin Weicker, the Catholic philosopher, said, the subtitle of it is How We All Became Hedonists. You see, pleasure lovers, because it became more and more possible as the 19th century gave way to the 20th that maybe we can indulge ourselves and not pay the consequences because we can control the consequences. The freedom to have abortions was a part of this dream, you see. Women as well as men had to be free to engage in sexual indulgence, pleasure to the utmost, without fear of pregnancy. They can get rid of the baby if an unwanted pregnancy occurs. And there's nothing wrong with that. After all, no one is harmed. That's the fallacious rationale, you see, that's given. It's just a part of the woman's body. It's her property. And no harm is done to any entity of which the law will take notice. So that freedom is also given. And freedom from sexually transmitted diseases was also promised. Now, this rather spectacularly has not come about. But that is simply a matter of, to those who think like Richard Dawkins, that further scientific research needs to be done. Until we actually will get the freedom of the vaccine for the sexually transmitted diseases, and it will all be all right. Well, that is, we saw some of the thinking that characterizes the scientific reductionist mentality in the speech that President Ronald Reagan's son, Ron Reagan, gave at the Democratic Convention. That's a week or two ago, where he pounded the drum for unrestricted embryonic stem cell research. And you see, that there again, you have, in the view of the scientific reductionists, like Richard Dawkins, and those who have been coached by them, like Ron Reagan, the view that what stands in the way of this cure for all diseases, this medical utopia, is just the foolish and squeamish objections of the religious people. And so if you get their way of thinking out of the way, then we can complete this program of freedom from disease. All we have to do is to give the scientists that study diseases the unrestricted ability to do whatever they feel that they need to do to develop the cures, in this case specifically cutting up human embryos to get the stem cells to use for stem cell transplants. We have to get rid of these squeamish and irrational objections to permit that program to go forward. Now, there is quite another side to that question. That story, the other side of the story, is told in another new book that has come out from our intelligent design movement and affiliated with the Discovery Institute right here in Seattle. It's a book by a scholar of German intellectual history named Richard Weikart, Weikart. And the title of the book is From Darwin to Hitler. And it is an academic. I have to admit to you that this book is not a great, you know, late night read. Although it might help to put you to sleep, I suppose. But it's a scholarly work. It's very important. I see, about how there is a straight line in the thinking, starting with Darwin, and especially Darwin's German bulldog Ernst Haeckel. See, you remember from last night, I referred to Thomas Henry Huxley as Darwin's bulldog, who carried the fight for Darwinism in British circles. In Germany, it was another disciple named Haeckel, who led the movement of Darwinian thinking into German intellectual thoughts. And this convinced the German professors and the scientists of 20th century Germany, that what Germany needed to do to become a great and happy nation was to undertake the kind of selective breeding that is explained in Darwin's books, so that you could get rid of the unfit, allow only the fit to breed, and then if necessary, you could kill off the unfit, which was a good thing to do because nature meant for them to be killed off anyway. That's what natural selection is the survival of the fit and the death of the unfit. So this would be a good thing to encourage. And in fact, in his second masterpiece, The Descent of Man, Charles Darwin stopped to explain why it is that if his theory of evolution is true, why is it that we do not see various creatures around us that are in between apes and humans? Where are all these missing intermediate types between apes and humans? He was speaking of the living world, not the fossil record at this point. Why aren't they there? And he said, well, this is because of the way natural selection operates. That as you bring about something new, like human beings, you kill off the old, which is their ape-like ancestors. That's the way natural selection operates. The improved varieties exterminate the unimproved varieties. It's this mass extermination is part of it. And Darwin went on to coolly predict that this process would continue as evolution proceeded in the future. He said, no doubt, the most evolutionarily advanced race of human beings, by which, of course, he meant his own, the English people, the white Europeans, would exterminate the less advanced races. So you would have only the white people left. And they wouldn't stop there either. It would probably go on to exterminate the higher apes, the chimps and the orangutans and gorillas, and so that the gap between the human and the non-human would become larger. It would be like the gap between a man and baboon. You wouldn't have these chimps anymore. Because that process of extermination is the way evolution works. Now, Darwin was not a bloodthirsty man. He did not advocate going out and exterminating anybody. He was a retiring country gentleman in poor health, very kind and civilized. You know, but his writing was the kind of thing that set the stage for the monstrous exterminations of human beings that occurred in the 20th century. It didn't take very much imagination for somebody reading those passages in the Descent of Man to think that, well, this is something that ought to be put into practice as a plan of action. And that's exactly what occurred in Germany. And it all very directly followed from the Darwinian thinking and the scientific reductionism and the sense that scientists must be free of any religiously originated restraints that would prevent them doing whatever they think is necessary to improve the world. Of course, the scientific reductionists don't include that episode in their story of the triumphs of science. They regard it as something that was not our fault. It was. And in fact, they like to think that Hitler was actually secretly a representative of the Catholic Church. This is often suggested in some way because he was born as a Catholic, so that must have been what he was up to. Now, naturally, the tendency of scientific reductionists is to tell the story of the triumph of science as one of a series of unbroken triumphs. Another thing that they do not emphasize, but that's very clear to me, and I'm sure to many of you from the times that you have lived through, is that when I went to college as a young man in the 1950s, the talk everywhere was about the great prophets of scientific reductionism for the 20th century, Sigmund Freud and Karl Marx. Marx and Freud were the great scientific thinkers. And both of them were great followers and admirers of Darwin. Marx took the Darwinist materialist view of history and gave it an explanation in terms of a clash of economic classes, the capitalists and the workers and so on, and the inevitable progress of history to a communist utopia. Left-wing social interpretation of Darwinism. There was a right-wing social interpretation as well, which was more dominant in Britain and the United States, which was that we saw the Darwinian struggle of the fit and the unfit in the economy. We should have a free market in which there was an unlimited opportunity for people to amass the property and wealth. And if some people were starved out in this process, that was just the Darwinian a process that ought to occur. So robber baron capitalism was another of the legacies of Darwinism in one part of the world, whereas Soviet Marxism was a different legacy. And then you had Freudian psychoanalysis. And the another reductionist interpretation that says that your thinking is not rational as you imagine it to be. It's all the product of childhood conflicts and things that are going on in your unconscious that you don't know anything about. So these ways of thinking were very dominant in the mid-20th century and respected everywhere as scientific, but now Marx and Freud have both lost their scientific status everywhere. Psychoanalysts are desperate to get patients so they can talk into getting on the couch and so on because they have been so discredited. They've been discredited by a new a panacea in the science of the mind, psychiatry. Now you have doctors who will give you drugs for everything that ails you, including feelings of depression and guilt. So you see, the materialist reductionist understanding has just taken a new guise, but the understanding that was dominant in mid-century has failed. So there are these failures of the reductionist program which are skirted over when somebody is giving the triumphalist story of what it involved. Now, going from strengths to weaknesses, one of the strengths of the Darwinist understanding in the view of the Darwinists is that it does what Epicurus said it was the job of science to do. Get rid of the myths, get rid of the gods, free us up from the troublesome prospect of a divine agency which interferes in the world. This divine agency might expect things of us, it might hold us responsible after death for what we've done, and we don't want to have anything to do with that. Also, it might continually mess up our understanding of the world by doing things we can't understand that we would call miracles. So we want to rule that out as any possibility, and that's a goal of the reductionist program. Now, again, the weakness side, going from strength to weaknesses, the great weakness of the reductionist program in this sense is that in getting rid of divine agency, saying that everything is the result of some combination of random events, chance, and physical laws. So there are two things operating in the world. There's chance, and there is rigid, repeatable physical law, and that's all that operates. Now, the scientific reductionists like Dawkins are very proud of extending this program to explain human thoughts. See, if everything is the product of chance forces or physical laws, and everything non-physical is a result of something physical, that's the underlying cause, if that's true, then we can explain human thoughts on that basis, too. One of the most aggressive scientific reductionists, Francis Crick, co-discoverer of the structure of the DNA molecule, I wrote a book called The Astounding Hypothesis, and in it he says that I'm going to offer the astounding hypothesis that you, dear reader, and all of your thoughts, all of your emotions, all of the theories that you hold are the product of neurons firing in your brain, chemical reactions in your brain, and nothing else. That's how Crick would explain your thoughts. Now, you notice that Crick said your thoughts, not my thoughts. And this is the great hidden secret of the reductionist program. Is that if the reductionist program is turned on itself, you see, it's quite an elementary logical exercise to see how it is true, if Francis Crick's thinking and Richard Dawkins' thinking and Charles Darwin thinking is just the result of chemical processes going on in their brains, then there is no reason to trust the thought products of these chemical reactions. They all have an irrational cause. Just as, you see, if you preferred to make an explanation in Freudian terms, if somebody's intellectual theories are simply the product of the way that they were treated in childhood by their mothers or fathers or hidden sexual longings that they have, then their thoughts are irrational and there's no reason to trust them. So it's no accident that Francis Crick applies his astounding hypothesis, which is not astounding at all. It's just materialist reductionism in very familiar form. He applies it to your thoughts, but not to his own thoughts. Nobody would want to buy his book if he did the latter. It wouldn't have any value. This was seen, I'm by no means the first person to have seen this, or the only person that anyone can scope it out that thinks it all. C.S. Lewis recognized the problem and discussed it in Miracles. Even J.B.S. Haldane, who was one of the founders of the Neo-Darwinian synthesis, the modern version of the theory, an ardent materialist and a communist, a hater of everything supernatural or Christian, said that, well, if my brain is composed of atoms and my thoughts are just the product of random or law-like motions of these atoms, then there is no reason to presume that my thoughts that are caused by these random physical movements are valid, and therefore no reason to think that my brain is composed of atoms. So even he recognized the contradiction that lies at the end of that path of certainty, that and somehow or another, the materialist reductionist always has to have something left over that will rescue him from this contradiction. This is spectacularly true in the case of Richard Dawkins. Now, who I had this dialogue with, Dawkins wrote his masterpiece that made him famous is a book called The Selfish Gene. See, and Dawkins said that everything we do or think is the product of the genes in our DNA. And the genes are competing with other genes. It's the genes that win out in the struggle for life and all that reproduce their own kind and so on. So at the genetic level, it's all just this pitiless law of the jungle. Our genes are like Chicago gangsters, he said. And we are puppets that are manipulated by our genes. Well, now, if he left it there, this would be very unpopular. People would be reluctant to believe it. And also, they would point out that isn't this a lot like the philosophy that led to all those things that happened in Germany? Doesn't this lead to a completely amoral world in which the strong prey pitilessly upon the weak? Is that what you have in mind? So Dawkins said, oh, no, that's not what I have in mind. I'm a socialist. I'm a left-wing professor in Britain. And he said, so if we understand what our genes are up to in this competition, then we can revolt. And we can take control from our genes and then achieve a socialist democracy utopia. So, what do you mean we, Professor Dawkins? Where's the we in this that exists independently? There is no we. the genes are everything. They're all that there are, according to his logic. But, of course, he cannot follow his logic to the end point. And again, when we'll see this move in the reductionist literature. Steven Pinker is a professor of psychology at MIT who writes along the same vein. He's a friend of Dawkins, and they appear together, write together. And Pinker says that we have to preserve morality. So he said, for purposes of morality, we have to believe that there's such things as freedom of the will, personal responsibility, that there are thinking selves who make choices and act. Otherwise, we have no responsibility. So we have to believe in these thinking selves and in freedom of the will and responsibility, even though science, properly understood, shows us that all these things are fictions and not real. But we have to believe in things that we know are not true, because otherwise we're at the end of the road. The weakness is in the self-contradiction that the materialist reductionist system ends up with. Another weakness is that, the materialist reductionist program starts out by saying, well, we aren't going to believe anything unless there is solid scientific evidence for it. And so we have to believe in things only when we can see, taste, smell, or touch them. The empirical knowledge we get from our senses is the only kind of knowledge. And now, of course, people's senses tell them different things. That's why there are disagreements. You think you saw one thing, and I think I saw something else. So we decide these disagreements by experimental tests, objectively controlled. And that's how we determine truth. And so sensory observation and experimental testing are how we get to truth, and it's the only way. Now, granted that, we certainly have to throw God out, don't we? Because where is God? Well, we don't see him. He's not there. We don't have an experiment that can demonstrate his existence. So God is outside of science, which means outside of reality. If we're good empirical scientists, we won't believe in any such thing. Here we come to the theory of evolution. And what we believe in is common ancestors. And that's where I started this talk, of course, with that common ancestor of the human and the lobster. Where do you see it, Richard? Where is that? Well, we don't see the common ancestors, but we know they must have existed, because the theory requires their existence. They aren't found in the living world, and they aren't found in the fossil record, but we know that they must have existed. Darwin himself wrote that he never would have known how incomplete the fossil record was until he found out that it completely failed to contain the necessary evidence of the common ancestors that are required by his theory. And that showed that there was something wrong, not with the theory, but with the fossil record. And now, likewise, we do not see natural selection, the process, ever doing any creating. But that also has to be true, regardless of whether we see evidence or not. And so, at the end, the Darwinists have to depart from the requirement that everything be derived from sensory observation and experimental testing, because their own theory cannot be justified in that basis. And that is why I started in talking about the strengths of the Darwinian system with the fact that it's a way of thinking that is congenial to modern people, because they imagine that it has been everywhere successful and triumphant, and that if they allow that way of thinking to proceed unhindered, they will come to a state of perfection, see, in which all health problems are abolished, and in which, at the end of the line, you see the vision of Star Trek. See, where we go to a utopia of harmonious, the multicultural, multi-ethnic crew going from planet to planet and having adventures which are perfectly safe, because if anything goes wrong, we can just say, beam me up, Scotty. this planet has become dangerous. And that is that the perfection at the end of the line. We can even download our memories and thought processes into silicon disks and computers and live forever. So that is the strength, and the lack of empirical confirmation is the weakness. Well, so much for today's lecture.